And it is 3 o'clock right now. This is Joshua Dixon, KLGR News Director, and we are interrupting our program for sort of a special news break. Every year when the legislative session ends, State Senator Gary Dames of Redwood Falls, State Representative Paul Torkelson of Hanska, who are both in our studio now, have hosted town hall meetings to give District 16B residents a chance to visit with their legislators. Do you guys ever mispronounce that word?
Yes.
Okay. Important issues here, and the current COVID-19 outbreak prevents the senator and the representative from meeting with constituents one-on-one. However, they've come up with a way to continue their annual town hall meeting tradition. They're doing it this year over the radio and responding to questions that have been submitted by listeners earlier in the week. And so we have Senator Dames, Representative Torkelson here in the studio now. For the next hour, we'll be getting their take on what's going on in Minnesota from the legislative standpoint. Hello.
Well, good afternoon, Josh.
Good afternoon, Josh.
Okay, and let's just jump off just sort of a overview of what you think the state of Minnesota is at right now. Representative Torkelson, you want to go first?
Okay, well, first I want to thank KLGR for having this event today. Appreciate that they're willing to let us do this. You know, as you said, normally we'd be at the library or town halls across the state doing these meetings, but this year it's going to be a virtual town hall. And that's not unlike a whole lot of other things we've done in the last few weeks. As far as our duties at the legislature, I've attended numerous Zoom meetings and WebEx meetings and conference calls, and we're trying to do our work as best we can, but in a whole new way where we don't meet each other face to face. And that's the way this town hall will be. We won't be able to meet each other face to face. I'm happy to be here. I am State Representative Paul Torkelson. I'm in my 12th year, or my 6th session, serving the district. Happy to do that, honored to serve the residents of Brown County, most of Redwood County, and a couple of townships in Renville County. It's been a great experience for me, and this year, however, the nature of the legislature has been a little different, as I said, and we really haven't finished our work. We anticipate, although the governor hasn't announced it officially yet, we are anticipating a special session coming up somewhere around the 12th of June. That would be appropriate in that the governor's emergency powers are running out, and there's some number of legislative issues that we have not finished yet, the big one being, of course, the bonding bill. And then there's a number of other things tied to that were either agreed to or almost agreed to during session. Seemed like everything took a little longer when we had to do it with virtual meetings. So looking forward to a special session, hope that it happens, and hope that we do get the work done. I'll turn it over at this time to my colleague, Senator Dames.
Well, thank you, Representative Torkelson, and thank you, Joshua, for hosting this today. I want to thank KLGR for doing that, and yourself for hosting it, and also thank all the folks in the KLGR land that are listening today. We truly do appreciate it. We wish we could be in front of you, but that is the way it is right now, and so Paul and I talked about it, and the radio stations are gracious enough to work with us so that we could make this happen, and we really do truly appreciate that. Things have changed a lot since COVID. February 11th we met, and that's when we opened up our session, and things looked very promising. We had a $1.5 billion surplus, and we had done a lot of tours for bonding and things like that, and we were ready for a good session. And as time went on, we got into the first part of March, and COVID showed up, and by I think it was the 16th of March, we were no longer meeting as normal with committees and at the on the floor sessions. And so shortly after that, we brought the floor sessions back, and you could either be there in person or virtually. And on the committee meetings, we took those all virtual and continued to hold our committee meetings. So we were able to get a lot of things done. However, a lot of the things we were doing were around the COVID issues and things like that. There's a lot of things that had to be done, and when those things were done and we come up with the money to do those things, then you'd have the unintended consequences that would have to be worked out and worked with in order to not have a bunch of unintended results. And so it's been a very interesting session, a very different session, and I didn't think that I would ever see when we would be holding virtual meetings and working out of our offices at our home, but we did that for a couple months. It worked out very well. And so today we just want to, we had a bunch of questions sent in, and we would just like to go through those and talk about kind of what did happen in the session. As Representative Torkelson alluded to, the Senate, we have a bonding bill, and the House had a bonding bill, but neither one of them got passed off the floor. There was a lot of work being done on housing, education, taxation, things like that. We got some of them off the floor in the Senate. I think there was some of that stuff got moved off the floor in the House, but conference committees and stuff, we didn't have the time to get those together because many hours were spent working on the COVID issues. So with that said, again, I am Senator Gary Dames, and I'm up for re-election. I'm finishing my third term, I believe it is, my 10th year. So we'll go from there, and we hope that we have a good conversation today.
Okay, we're going to start off. I just should let the listeners know that this isn't a call-in show. And so the way it worked is last week, we put the word out. And a number of people throughout the area submitted questions in advance, and I've got a list of some of the questions in front of me right now, and we're going to see how many we can get through right now. And Representative Torkelson, in your opening statement, you said something that I think is going to answer some of the questions that people have specifically about the governor's powers. In the questions that were submitted last week, there are a lot of very... shall we say, upset people who are questioning what right the governor has to be shutting down so much of the state. And in your statement, you said the governor's emergency powers are running out. And so could you go into that a little bit or say, well, what legal basis the governor has to be making decisions affecting people's businesses?
Well, in time of emergency, the governor can declare an emergency, and that gives him certain emergency powers. Those powers are set to last for 30 days, at which time the legislature can end them. But that would mean that both bodies of the legislature would have to vote to say that the emergency is over. So far, in the House of Representatives, the Democrat majority in the House, led by the Speaker of the House, Melissa Hortman, has been unwilling to consider ending the emergency powers. We voted a number of times on the House to do that, and I voted for that. Not that we would end all of his emergency orders, but that we would cooperate with him, that the legislature and the governor would work together to decide which of these emergency edicts are appropriate and which aren't. That didn't happen, so he still has those powers, and they will continue until June 12th, at which time we have the opportunity as a legislature to end them, but we don't know how that might go come special session. That remains to be seen. You know, I have to say that at the beginning of this, we were all in cooperation. We didn't know much about this disease. We didn't know how virulent it was or how fast it might sweep across the state of Minnesota. We were working hand in hand with the governor. But as time has gone on, we've seen that some of these emergency orders fall very unevenly across the state. And here in my district, we've had a very low incidence of the virus compared to other parts of the state. We've had very few deaths, and our businesses are really hurting. It's their lifeblood. And we believe, or at least I believe, that there are safe ways that they could reopen their businesses, respecting how important it is to be careful and how important it is to protect our most vulnerable citizens, and those are especially folks in the nursing home and other elderly folks that are in congregate care situations, but that we can open some things up more aggressively than we have been. With that, I'll let Senator Dames give us his reaction.
Well, it is, the governor does have those authorities, and June 12th, I'm sure will call us back into session. If he doesn't, call us into session, which he don't have to do, but then he'd have to give up his powers because he has to bring us back into session and give both bodies an opportunity to vote to take away his powers. I don't see the House DFL majority voting to take his powers away. I would assume that he'll call us back in. I think he would like to have a bonding bill. However, he did call the members of the Senate, the DFL members of the Senate, and convince them that they should not vote for the bonding bill. And so our bonding bill was defeated because we do need six members of the Senate DFL to vote for it in order to pass it. So I'm not sure at this point if he wants a bonding bill or not. There is $1.8 billion worth of money that came from the federal under the Federal CARES Act, and that was sent to the state of Minnesota. And the that's the governor has the authority to manage and spend that money as he sees fit. We've been trying to negotiate with him, and we've passed a bill trying to negotiate with him in order to get the legislative body involved so that we could help make some of those decisions and work with the governor on how that money should be spent. And needless to say, that has not materialized. And so if he would decide not to continue with his powers, he would still have the authority how he could spend that $1.8 billion. And where my concern really comes in that process is that the Ramsey County and Hennepin County were paid directly from the federal government a total of about $337 million for their share of the CARES money. The balance of the counties, cities, municipalities, and townships were to get money out of the money, this $1.8 billion. So if we take a look at what that would amount to, it would be $174.50 per individual in outstate Minnesota. And that would equal what Ramsey and Hennepin County got. There's where we're having a little bit of struggle because the governor would like, and that's $667 million. And what the governor would like to do is take that $667 million and divide it by the entire state population, which would bring Hennepin and Ramsey County back in the double dip. And I'm not very pleased about that because, again, rural Minnesota needs to be treated equally and fairly. And we certainly have issues. You know, maybe we don't have the number of deaths, maybe we don't have the number of positive cases, but we certainly have a major impact just like any other community does. And so this money can be used in various ways. And so I'm a little disappointed in that, but we'll see what happens June 12th.
Just before we move on to a different topic, you mentioned about the bonding bill. And you might have kind of sort of answered this question that was sent in from a listener. The question goes, could the legislature, or at least the Senate, pledge no deals to anything about the never-ending power of the statewide lockdown until it's removed from the governor's office? And so that seems to be sort of advocating for a stalemate.
Well, yes, to answer the question, yes, we could do some things that would, and just say we won't give, you know, we won't put a bonding bill on the table until, you know, he gives up his powers or allows us to be part of those decisions, things like that. But there's two sides to this. Basically, the bonding bill is probably the only thing that we really have that could be of leverage. But as a governor, he has a $1.8 billion pot of money that right now he has the authority to do what he wants to do. And so we want to negotiate with him to, like I said, have some input on how that money will be spent so that we can protect rural Minnesota and get our fair share. So I'm not so sure who has the strongest card. Right now we have a card of bonding, but he has the card that he's holding the money there, and if he doesn't bring us back in the special session, we have no way to get him to agree on a bill to allow us to be part of that. So yes, we could withhold a bonding bill, but I think at the end we're better off to try to negotiate to get some input on how that $1.8 billion will be spent in order to protect rural Minnesota versus saying we won't have a bonding bill until we get that. Because I'm not so sure at this point, the way he encouraged the DFL to vote against the Senate bonding bill, I'm not sure that he really needs a bonding bill or feels he does. So that would be my position on that.
And so it would be a case of you trying to use leverage and finding out you don't have as much as you thought you did.
In a sense, that'd be a good summary, yes.
Okay. From the perspective of the House, yeah, on the bonding bill, listeners might remember that earlier in the session, Kurt Dowd, our minority leader, said that he was not going to allow a bonding bill out of the House unless the governor gave up his emergency powers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that I think the landscape has changed a bit since then. The governor has loosened up on a number of restrictions, and that loosening continues as he moves toward a more open economy. If we refuse to have a bonding bill, that hurts people too, because bonding projects do impact the state's economy and jobs specifically. It takes a little longer than some people think to get those bonding projects moving, but yet there are some very important projects for greater Minnesota. The bonding bill that we vote on in special session, I suspect, will be very heavy on infrastructure. That's wastewater and drinking water treatment plants. That's roads and bridges across the state, which are really important for greater Minnesota and for local governments across greater Minnesota. So we'll see. It's a negotiation process. And as Gary said, it's one of the few cards that we hold because the bonding bill does require that supermajority. It's really important to remember that only the governor can call a special session, but only the legislature can end a special session. So it gets to be a very important negotiation. Typically, when we go to special session, the governor and the legislature have agreed in advance exactly what's going to be covered in that special session. We go in and do that work, and we end it. There's a possibility that this year we might have an open-ended special session that could continue for a period of time to deal with COVID issues, but I doubt if that will happen.
One listener wrote in with a question saying, what projects specifically are included in the House and Senate bills for the bonding? And just so to let people know what you're voting on.
Yeah, I described a few of those. This is Paul Torkelson again. Yeah. I did describe a few of those already. Local roads, local bridges, local water infrastructure, both wastewater and drinking water. We've got potentially, now the bill hasn't been written. It's still being negotiated.
Okay. So as far as specific projects?
The Senate bill and the House bill were dramatically different.
Okay.
Both in size and content. So there's a lot of work going on behind the scenes right now to figure out what might be in the bonding bill. One of the projects that I'm advocating for is more funding for our short line railroads, including the Minnesota Valley Railroad. That's really important to our rural economy, especially here in this part of the state. I'll let Gary mention other projects if he likes to.
Yes, in the Senate bill, it was a $998 million bill, just shy of $1 billion, and we had $660 million in transportation in bridges and things like that for transportation infrastructure, which would encompass a lot of things. $207 million was in there for the water and sewer for small communities that need water and sewer upgrades and updates, and so there was $207 million for that. There was $100-plus million in there for HEPR, which is money for our local colleges, state colleges, and the university. And there's a lot of impact in rural Minnesota with the HEPR dollars because we have a lot of colleges in rural Minnesota between the four-year and the two-year program. So that's always in there. We had, I think it was $16 million total for short line railroads. Of that, $13 was directed at Minnesota Valley Rail Line, which is five counties own that, one of them being Redwood County. There was some other money in there for some ag issues, and It was a very strong bill. It wasn't, it was under $1 billion, but a very strong bill.
Every day when I drive to work here at KLGR Studios, I drive by Lake Redwood. And so it's occurred to me, I know the funding for that has been approved with a sudden huge deficit. Is there any danger of funding being pulled for projects where the funding has already been approved?
A very good question, Joshua. No, the money won't be pulled from that. That was actually money that was in the bonding bill last year, I believe it was, or the year before. And so that money's already dedicated. So that money's not going to disappear. That project will go ahead. They're working on, as I understand, getting all the background work done. And so I assume it's either going to be late this fall or early next spring that they'll actually start the dredging. But the bonding bill was done 2 years ago. That bonding bill a lot of those bonds have been sold and stuff already, and that bill will move forward.
Got it. Mm-hmm. Now, there is two questions here that were submitted that strike me as being related. I'll just say both questions, and then Representative Torkelson, you can jump in. Here's a question. 700,000 Minnesotans are out of work, the most since the Great Depression. What can be done to reopen the state and get people back to work? And then right after that is a separate question. Someone saying, Greater Minnesota has a workforce shortage. There aren't enough people to fill the jobs we have. How can the state help businesses find, train, and house workers? Do you see a relationship between those questions?
Well, I certainly do. Before I go to that, I just want to mention one other project. You asked about projects potentially being canceled. The other one that I believe will not be canceled is Highway 14 from Nicollet to New Ulm. It's not in our district, but it leads right up to our district. Mm-hmm. It's been a long time coming, and I have every reason to believe that project will also be completed. I know it's important to a lot of listeners in this part of the state. Just wanted to mention that. Getting to the housing and labor force question that you asked earlier, Prior to COVID coming along, the listener is absolutely right. We did have businesses that really couldn't find enough workers. We have turned up the heat on our technical schools to try and get them up to date and training more people for these job openings. And part of the secret there is for the schools to work with the businesses. Things have gotten so technologically advanced for many of these jobs that the equipment they use is equipment that these schools really can't afford. But the businesses have the equipment. They can help get it into the schools. And we've seen it right here in Redwood Falls, as a matter of fact. The addition to the high school is a great addition. That mm-hmm. is aimed at those technical hands-on kind of jobs that are available here in Greater Minnesota, and we need to make sure that we have trained workers coming out of our local schools that are ready to take those jobs.
As Paul alluded to, we have 700,000 folks that are on unemployment, and that's a lot of folks. I think once businesses are allowed to open up for larger capacities, most of the businesses that are being opened up right now are being opened up at about 25% capacity. And so if we can get those folks up, start getting up to that 100% capacity, that's going to make a difference in how many of these people go back to work. And as Paul alluded to, there's been a lot done with the VOTEC programs, and he mentioned Redwood Falls. That's a very good example. Fairmont's a very good example. There are several. New Ulm has a great program over there. Many of our schools have now put together a really good program, and the Southwest Minnesota Co-op has been very instrumental in working with these schools. I think they have 18 counties and school districts in those counties that they work, and they've been able to, as well as like our local schools, have been able to work a lot with the local businesses and form a partnership there in order to help with the training and things like that. So that's very important. One of the issues we're running into right now, and it's kind of a double-edged sword, but when we had a lot of people going on unemployment, Minnesota stepped up, and there was a 7-day waiting period. We voted to take that 7-day waiting period away, which I'm perfectly comfortable with. And they got paid their regular, like they would normally as far as their percentages.
Mm-hmm.
And then the federal government came along and paid out $600 a week on top of that. And so what is happening, unfortunately, and I get calls every day from folks, because what's happening is that they can't get their workers to come back to work in many cases because they're making considerably more between the federal and the state program. And the federal is now talking about extending that. And I had talked to the federal when this program was put into place, and I asked them if we could coordinate, because I felt that, we should take the federal funds and the state funds and coordinate instead of paying more than what you were making, certainly no less than what you were making. And I kind of felt an 80% number would probably be a pretty good number to settle at, but that didn't happen. And now with them extending it, there's a lot of concern about if they will coordinate or not, and there's some talk about doing that, which I think would be beneficial, because we do have a lot of people unemployed and we want to get them back to work. But on the other hand, people that have the opportunity to go back to work, and some of them are choosing not to because they're making more money not working, and I can understand that. I mean, it's pretty hard to tell somebody, well, you got to go back to work when you're making $150 a week more by not going mm-hmm. back to work.
Yep.
So it's something that we need to work out you know, at the government level with the state and the federal, we need to get that worked out. But I do think as we get these businesses opened up, we'll see a lot more people going back to work. It'll be a while before we probably have a shortage, but I do think there's a lot of opportunity for people to get back to work here the next 3-4 months, for sure.
Joshua,
you've pointed out a very, and Gary, you've pointed out a very important issue is with unemployment. It's also, people need to feel like they're going back to a safe workplace. I think part of the reason that people are unwilling to go back to work when it's offered are they're not quite sure if their workplace is going to be safe. So employers, I know, are taking steps to make their workplaces safe, and that's an important part of this too. But I would hope that our system would incentivize people going back to work rather than incentivize people staying home. There should be some changes made in that to make it work that way. When people are working, they're paying their taxes and contributing to the economy. When they're not, of course, we're adding to our debt.
Yeah. The way the situation is right now, the governor can say, okay, I'm going to allow you to open your business to 50% capacity, but good luck getting your employees to actually come back until the end of July or whatever the deadline is. Here's something, it's not one of the questions that was sent in, but it's something that just popped into my head right now. Both of you, from your constituents, what are you hearing in terms of businesses in this district that are closing and never coming back? Are you hearing of a lot of incidences of that?
So far, not a lot, but we know that there are many businesses that are on the edge. I know there was a restaurant in Winthrop, for instance, that announced last week it was closing its doors. It's just outside of our district. A lot of these employers are hanging on, hoping this economy comes back. And there is some help for employers out there. The Paycheck Protection Program from the federal government has helped them through some of this difficult time. But we're kind of nearing the end of the rope for some of these businesses. And that's another reason why opening them safely is really important.
Gary, have you heard anything about businesses closing?
Yes, for well, like Paul said, you know, people are contacting us in explaining the dire situation they're in, and they don't have much time left before they won't be able to reopen, and that time is closing in. So I think that it won't be long, and we'll have more people that actually will not be able to be open, and hopefully that doesn't happen. But I'm afraid it is around the corner. The state of Minnesota, I think, has 3 or 4 grant programs that we have put out through DEED. And in my newsletter, usually we highlight those in the newsletter so people can see who they have to call and stuff. But there are various grants available. There's still some money in those. And it's, I think the day that we finished session, I know we did approved another one that day, and I think that got passed out of the House and over to the governor. And that was a pretty sizable number of millions of dollars that went into that program to try to help people move forward. Another thing that has helped is the federal government has allowed some of the business owners that did not qualify for unemployment, the federal government has allowed those folks to get unemployment through the federal program, so that has helped too.
With that, specifically, say, include salon owners? I think I recall that they weren't allowed to be on unemployment.
If in Minnesota, if you had an option, if you were an individual owner without employees and you wanted to be on unemployment, you could. You needed to sign up, not as far as a benefit, but to have benefits, you needed to pay in just like anybody else with employees does. And people had that independent. Business owners had that opportunity. Now, with that said, very, very few of them signed up. So in Minnesota, most people, individuals, were not eligible for Minnesota unemployment because they never signed up as far as to get originally enrolled and pay in on the program. So if something happened, they could get funding, you know, they could get benefits at the end of the, you know, when something happened.
Okay.
But this was a federal program that allowed individual businesses to be eligible for unemployment.
Okay. One last coronavirus question before we move on to others, unless another one occurs to me. This is a submitted question. What has the legislature done to help frontline workers, firemen, police, and ambulance workers who become infected with COVID-19 while they are on the job?
Okay.
We did pass legislation that allows those frontline workers to qualify for the workers' comp program. If they do come down with COVID, I forget the exact term, but they don't have to prove that they caught it when they were on the job. They can they qualify for that unemployment coverage. That goes out to our firefighters and policemen and other frontline workers. So we did take action there. What's unclear is whether or not the federal money will help us pay for that, but those are some of those things that we have to work through, and maybe that's been cleared up in the meantime. I don't know.
Well, there was two parts to the bill. The original part was the preemption, so that if they came down, as Paul alluded to, if they came down with the virus, they didn't have to prove where they got the virus at. They would be included in coverage, and there are 17 different classes that were included. And then the second piece of it was the funding. And so I headed up the committee that worked on the funding to try to figure out how we're going to fund that. And so we come up with a bill. We passed it off the Senate floor. The House originally was in support of it. And what we would do is take $375 million, which would be the average projected number of dollars that would be needed above and beyond the normal workers' compensation cost. And so we took that out of this $1.8 billion CARES money, and the governor is not interested in doing that. So, in fact, I just sent out the letter today to folks, the governor and the commissioners that are working on this, asking them to reconsider, because if we don't, then the money's going to come out of the WECR, which is a Workers' Compensation Reinsurance Fund, and that's got about $1 billion in it. And 80 to 85% of that money is already committed to prior claims. So what will happen is if we let this go without committing money either out of the general fund or out of the CARES Act money, we will end up bankrupting the workers' compensation fund. Then what happens is there will be assessments. And so it will get assessed back to our townships, our counties, our cities. And those assessments would be just almost brutal. And so we need to figure out a way to cover the hospitals, the counties, the cities, and the self-insured, so that the money isn't coming back in assessments. It's coming out of the CARES money. And that's the most likable place. So I don't know how far we'll get on that. But if we have a special session, that's certainly one of the things that's going to be in the negotiations, that it comes out of CARES versus bankrupting RCRA.
Okay. Let's move on to hopefully slightly more pleasant topics than COVID-19. This is a question that was sent in. Housing continues to be a problem, especially in rural parts of the state. What is the Republican plan to address the high cost and shortage of housing?
In the Senate, Sunday afternoon, the last day of session, we passed a housing bill. We passed a housing bill, and in that housing bill, there were several things, but there was $100 million for new workforce in low-income housing throughout the state, and there was another $100 million for emergency type of housing issues, trying to make sure that people could pay their rent and things like this during this time. So we put $200 million into housing in order to help that, and that's a considerable amount more than what we usually put in. We usually put in a fairly large amount, but this was kind of above and beyond what we usually do. And there was some, the governor did not sign the bill because there was some issues in, for instance, right now we want it set up so that you could take like a Schulte-Mobile home, and that would qualify for low income and for workforce housing. And that if they wanted to do a duplex, they could do, you know, we could do that and still have that qualify. One of the problems we've got right now with low-income housing is the restrictions are so tough and the rules and regulations are so tough that the cost is just astronomical compared to what people can do for regular housing. So what happens is many contractors aren't interested in getting into low-income housing because the cost is so high with all the hoops they have to jump through and things like that. So we did have some relief on some of that stuff out in rural Minnesota where some of the rules and regulations that you'd need in the cities probably don't apply out here, but we'll see how far it went. I don't believe the House passed it, And so it's sitting over on their desk, and I think the reason they didn't is because the governor was objecting to it. He wanted to take some of the rules and regulations and change those. So we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, I believe housing is one of the important issues that we will address given a special session. There is money there, and there's also bonding dollars. We issue appropriation bonds for housing finance. So those are all things we can do short term. Longer term, I think Gary mentioned how contractors aren't really interested. I think that's partially because we so highly regulate housing. If we would make it easier to for these contractors to build and properly construct these houses in an affordable manner, I think we'd see a lot more of them being built. So on one hand, government needs to help out with the money we have available. On the other hand, government needs to step out of the way and let contractors build.
So I'm trying to remember, several years ago, probably about 3 years ago, I went on a tour of Schult Homes, and this was one of the very topics that they were bringing up, is that they, at that point, it was just beginning to be mentioned that maybe there's a possibility that the sort of housing that they construct could be included in these housing bills for low-income housing. And what exactly is the objection?
You know, I'm not sure exactly what the objection is. I think this is more of a union objection than it is anything. And we can't get the commissioners. They're just not interested in that change. But keep in mind that an awful lot of these homes are made in rural areas of the states, be it Minnesota or wherever.
Mm-hmm.
And in many cases, they're not unionized. And so we're seeing a lot of pushback coming back from the unions.
Okay, that sort of relates to a question that was sent in. And this is sort of a bigger picture issue. It says, this is what was sent to us. What is your plan to take back power and control to make decisions locally when we know more about how to run our own lives than St. Paul does?
Well, I personally am a big proponent of local control, whether it be in our schools or in our healthcare systems or in our businesses. I believe school boards, for instance, are elected for a reason. They're elected because they know their community, they understand the issues in the community. Too often, state and federal government sends funds out to our local units of government, but they come with so many strings attached that it's hard for these local communities, whether it be the school board or the county board or whoever, to utilize those funds effectively when they know what needs to be done, but these strings that are attached to these funds kind of tie their hands. And that same thing comes with other regulations where you've got to do it the government way or you can't do it. That really is a problem. And I'm a strong believer in local control, as I said earlier, and I hope that we can keep moving in that direction.
Well, I think the best government you got is at the local level. You know, you start townships, and that's about as pure as government as you're going to get, and on up through the cities and the counties. And these folks are working with the issues every day, and they know what fits their communities better. In rural Minnesota, They understand what they need to do, and the governments out here understand what they can make work and what's not going to work. And too many times, their voices, when it gets to St. Paul, fall on deaf ears, and it's really unfortunate because, like I've said many a times, the best decisions are made by the people with their feet on the streets, your school boards, your county, city councils, your county commissioners, your township officers. That's where the best decisions are made. These people got their heartbeat and a pulse on what's going on. And so I've always said we really need to rely on those folks to make the decisions, and that we should provide some funding for them and let them decide the best way for them to use that to accomplish what they need to accomplish.
And I hate to go back to COVID, but I think our reaction to the COVID crisis is a good example of that. As I look at what's happened in these last many weeks, I look across our state borders to what's happening in the Dakotas and Iowa and Wisconsin. Their statistics are about the same, maybe a little better than ours, but yet they have much fewer restrictions on their citizenry and their businesses. I think we in greater Minnesota could open things up more aggressively and safely, but we've applied, the governor and the administration have applied the same regulations across the state, no matter what your population density or the base of your economy is. We got to understand that Minnesota really has a multifaceted economy and citizenry, and we need to understand that as we create these rules and regulations.
Maybe 10 or so years ago, no, it would have been more than that, I went to a speech, and I can't remember her name offhand. It was Governor Pawlenty's lieutenant governor, and she was giving a talk, and a lot of it was just stuff you could get off of press releases. There was nothing really original in it, and it was great to see her let down her guard and just... a dairy farmer asked her a question about the regulations that were affecting his specific ranch, his area. And he was saying, do the people in St. Paul, most of them have the slightest idea of how their policies affect all of us out here in rural America? And she dropped her guard and she said no. She said they don't have any clue. And so realistically, what can the people in greater Minnesota do about any of this, except, I mean, we can write letters, but like you say, they fall on deaf ears. Letters, emails, phone calls. What can we do?
Well, I think one of the things is that, you know, there's a lot of associations that represent a lot of people out here, and they certainly have been very instrumental in getting the rural voice, you know, the rural voice heard by legislators, and certainly keep in contact with, you know, with your local legislators. One of the reasons we do town hall meetings and things like that is because we want to, and unfortunately today we can't have that interaction, but we want that interaction to find out what really is affecting people and how legislation has or will affect them and things like that. And I make a lot of phone calls for people out in rural Minnesota when I'm at St. Paul. When we got a piece of legislation comes up, if it affects the schools, many a times I've give Rick a call, or other superintendents a call, certainly call business people. Depending on what entity it will affect, I make phone calls to find out what the impact will be and get some idea what people think, because that helps me make decisions as to how things are going to be. I think I've got a pretty good heartbeat of what's going on in rural Minnesota, but it never hurts to get that solidified by contacting rural people, local people that are working with those issues or that will be affected by them. So that's one of the things that I think works out fairly well.
Okay, anything?
I think Gary said it very well.
Oh, okay. Okay, so you'll just turn it over. Here is a question that was sent in. Several people had questions about the whole rural broadband issue. And I think it was a local educator who actually pointed out that with all the homeschooling going on, the whole issue of rural broadband is something people are becoming aware of in a way that they weren't 2 months ago. So do you have any thoughts about that?
Sure. I have to say that just yesterday I participated in a sixth grade class via Zoom. And as I was participating in that class and I was looking at, some of the kids had their video on and some didn't, and I saw those names of those sixth graders up on the screen, I thought back to my time of teaching, and I thought how challenging it must be for the teachers, for the parents, and for the students to effectively run an education system on the internet. I'm sure that there have been some serious challenges. One of those challenges, of course, is the technology. While laptops are pretty much available, I think, to students, not every student has got the internet access to really utilize that technology at home in the way that they need to get their education. We've been talking about rural broadband at the state level for years. We've made some progress. It's a little hard for state government to keep up with the technology as it continues to change, but it's something we need to keep working on. We did address it in a small way this year, but we need to keep that moving in the right direction where we get good access to technology all across the state, no matter where you live. I can't help, and many people have made this analogy, but think back to when we electrified the state and how we got it to every farm site across the state through the programs that were available at that time. This broadband technology really kind of needs the same effort behind it.
Well, we certainly found out where some of our strong points are and some of our weak points are when it comes to broadband in rural Minnesota. We've got some real issues out here when it comes to availability. And so we usually put about $30 million per biennium into broadband. This biennium we put in $40 million, and now this year we put in another $18 million, $10 million for rural broadband, and then $8 million for school districts to use to help them do things internally and whatever they need to make their systems more efficient. But we still got a long ways to go. And it certainly would have been, you know, if we look back, the way to do it would have been, like Paul alluded to, like the REAs would have had as a public utility. Unfortunately, to the point we're at now, we've got a lot of private, and then we have those pockets to where we don't have very much success because it's, you know, the last mile that's that very expensive mile, and so it's hard to get people to do it. So we come up with some programs. I think we started it 4 years ago, and that would be some grants where the community and the providers could work together and share some of that cost through a grant program through the state in order to try to reach out to those last miles where it's very expensive. And so we may have to do some more money into that program because this online education really, like I say, really pointed out where our weaknesses are. And we have some real issues, and it's really tough on these students. And so different schools done different things. They were they really worked hard to figure out ways to manage this and make it work. But it did point out the areas that we need to work with, that's for sure.
Okay, I just want to clarify something. You're talking about rural broadband, and you're saying there's some pockets where it's just not getting out there, the signals just aren't getting. And so how much of that is really the government's responsibility? How much of it is the responsibility of private companies? And for the private companies, is it just coming down to a question of cost effectiveness? It's not cost effective for them to do that final mile, and that's where government steps in?
That basically is, you've outlined it quite effectively there. You know, these companies just really can't afford to invest thousands of dollars into one location where they're only going to get a very small return on that. So that's where our broadband program from the state has been helping out to incentivize these companies to reach out and do those last miles.
And one question that I used to work in newspapers, that a listener suggested, saying, would the legislature consider making broadband internet a utility or at least striking anti-competitive language from regulations?
Gary kind of outlined that already, that making it a utility is probably, that horse has left the stable already.
It's too late for that one.
Do that.
Okay.
I'm not familiar with that particular issue in legislation that the listener mentioned. I don't know if Gary had a chance to look that up or not, but I did not.
I didn't look it up, but it seems to me it's about competitiveness.
That's happened to me too.
Yeah. And, that statute gives communities a lot of authority to do a lot of things, and it gives the community some things they can do in broadband. However, it limits how competitive they could be. And so, you know, we really did address that. Like I was saying, about 4 years ago, we came up with a program that did allow would allow a city or a community to work with the provider, and the city would apply for a grant and work with the provider to provide those services. And so I'm not so sure it's as non-competitive as I'm not sure how much non-competitive that is, that clause in there. If I haven't, I should look at the statute and really see. I think I'm familiar with it, but I think that we did address that, and I think right now we probably need to put some more funding into it so we get more of those cooperations between the providers and the communities, and they use more of those state grant dollars to do that.
Okay, we're closing in on our last 10 minutes or so, and so I'm just going to ask you to sort of look ahead. It's impossible to predict anything, obviously. 2 months ago, we didn't know we were going to be where we are right now. And there's a special session coming up. There's a regular session a few months down the road. And so just sort of looking ahead, what are you sort of preparing for, or what are the big issues that you think are coming up in the next, well, year and a half, say?
Well, I think the biggest issue, well, I mean, COVID is obviously a very big issue, and it's still there, and it still has to be dealt with, and we don't know how long it's going to be before it slows down, or it's not going to go away for a while. But piggybacking off of that is the deficit. And we have a $2.5 billion deficit right now, and that's after we already spent our $1.5 billion surplus. However, we have a rainy day fund of around that, roughly that same amount. But we're going to have to, in the state of Minnesota, you have to have a balanced budget. So we have an unbalanced budget right now by $2.5 billion. And so we will have another forecast that's done a little different than the normal monthly what we get. And one was done in May, and that's what put us on the track of rough announcing the $2.5 billion. Another one will be the first week in August, and that will kind of give us a little better idea. And unfortunately, I think when we get that one, it's going to be worse. And I'm assuming then at that point we will probably go back into session, I'm not sure, and start dealing with that, because we will, at January 1st, we'll only have 6 months then to deal with that deficit. And so if we could get back in early fall, you know, we could expand that from 6 to, you know, maybe up to as much as 9 to 10 months to manage that deficit. And we're going to have to figure out a way. And I don't think that it's in our best interest to just take the $2.5 billion rainy day fund and apply to that. I think we need to start looking at more creative ways, because we get back in January, then we're for the next biennium, and we easily could see a deficit. I mean, they're talking right now somewhere between $4 and $6 billion deficit the next biennium. So we've got some major issues financially, and we're going to have to deal with those. And so I think that's the next big issue on the horizon, quite frankly.
Well, I'd have to agree with Gary. The deficit is going to be a very big issue. I was in the legislature. We were in the legislature when we had over a $6 billion deficit to deal with. I know how challenging that is, how controversial it becomes when we have to make cuts and make changes in the state budget to accommodate that deficit. And as Gary said, we have to balance the budget. That's why I would advocate for looking for ways to save money in this current biennium. We got almost a year, a little over a year actually, left in the current biennium. I believe there are things we could do to start saving money now. I'm not going to list them today, but let me say it this way. I think we should be looking at ways that we can save money now so that we decrease that deficit coming up in the next biennium. There are some hopeful signs. I had a chance to talk to the commissioner of the Department of Transportation just this week. They had issued a forecast about the gas tax and a huge drop in gas tax collections. She told me on the phone the other day that that drop is not as severe as they anticipated. So maybe there's a little more life left in this economy than we think. And if there is, in that case, the sooner we kind of get it moving again, the better. Because those revenues are what drive the system. And if we're short of revenues, then we've got to cut. And then some of those cuts involve cutting jobs. And that then gets to be kind of a vicious circle of you're cutting jobs and decreasing the size of the economy, and it leads to more cuts. So we have a very challenging time ahead of us. We've made it through it before. Minnesota is a strong state. We have great businessmen and women across the state that pitch in when the time comes, but that does not make it easy. And I would agree with Gary. I think the deficit is a big problem. In the area of transportation, however, there's a number of construction projects going on right now, and I'm glad they are. They were funded in the last number of years, and I've encouraged them to be more aggressive. For instance, I know there's a project going on in the vicinity of the MSP airport, and it's a great time for them to do it because the airport traffic is down, so they can work on the road without too much traffic. So mm-hmm. there are some opportunities here, too, but looking ahead to the next session, deficit.
In terms of getting through the deficit, it's a moving target, and so tax revenues are down. It's not just a matter of cutting programs at the government level. It's the amount of money that's coming in right now because of all the business closures and such. And so how do you take that into account?
Well, that's probably going to broaden the deficit projections as we go, because in May, I think they are finding that it's much more severe than what they thought it was going to be in some of the areas of taxation, especially in sales tax. And so that's just going to make it just a little deeper. To give you some idea, right now we have about a $46 billion budget, and so if we've got a $4 to $5 billion deficit in the next biennium, that's a 10% across the board cut to have mm-hmm. a balanced budget.
Mm-hmm.
So now throw the 2.5 from this year in, now we're up to say 7.5. Now we're in that 15-16% cut. If it gets to the max outside of maybe an 8 to a 9, and I do not think it'll get there. I don't want people to think I think this, but if it would get up to that 8 or 9 billion, we could be looking at a 20% cut across the board if you were to do that. If you were just going to say, okay, we're going to take whatever percent we need across the board, we could get 18 to 20%. That would be very, very, very tough.
And politically, is that in a sense the simplest way to do it, where you just say to everybody in the government, okay, everybody shares equally, you all get a 10% cut?
You know,
is that something that Republicans and Democrats and the governor could all potentially agree on?
Politically, it would be the easiest for us. But, you know, we have some factors, we have some segments in the economy that when it comes to the disabled and a lot of those folks, they can't take these kind of cuts. They've really never gotten up into the level as far as when you take people working in these homes for the disabled and stuff, their salaries are just not there compared to a lot of other places. And so if you were to do a 20% cut, it would just be devastating. But it would be easiest for us just to do a 20%, but I don't see that happening because there's too many people that the impact would be so much more severe than a different sector.
I agree. It won't be an across-the-board cut. It's just really impossible to do it that way. It sounds simple and easy, but it's really not. There are some of these dedicated spending streams that we just really can't cut. And the other big question mark is what will be the impact of other federal changes, possibly another COVID bill at the federal level that might come in to help us at the state level. We don't know. And so it's kind of a wait and see. But I would go back to saying that every dollar saved now is a dollar we won't have to cut in the next biennium. Gary mentioned our folks that take care of some of our neediest citizens in our nursing homes and group homes across the state. I think this current crisis with COVID has really revealed the value of those workers, but they're not paid according to their values. So it's an area that we've worked on in the past. We've made some progress. I think this current situation points out that there's more work to be done there.
Okay, we're pretty much out of time. Could we get a quick closing statement and please something vaguely optimistic if you can manage it?
Well, I want to thank KLGR Radio, thank the listeners, and thank Senator Dames for participating in this today. I am optimistic about the state of Minnesota. It's a great state. We have a lot going for us. I'm a farmer by trade. We didn't talk much agriculture today, but agriculture is having its own series of issues. But we're off to a good start with this planting season. I've seen a lot of smiles on farmers' faces just because of the fact that they can get out there and get their work done. So that makes me optimistic, and I hope it all goes well for the citizens of District 16B.
Very good. Thank you.
Well, I'd also like to thank KLGR for hosting this. We certainly appreciate it, and Joshua, certainly appreciate your doing this for us today. And I want to also thank the listeners. And we had put out a survey and asked people how small businesses and business people and whatever, how could they, if they could lay out a plan, how they felt they could go back into business and meet all the criteria of the CDC and the MDH. The Center for Disease Control and Minnesota Department of Health. And you can't believe the plans that we got back. We got a lot of plans back from people. And I'll tell you what, these entrepreneurs really put a lot of thought into it. And they're ready to be opened up. And they have plans on how they can meet the requirements. And so it was very, very enlightening and certainly makes you feel very optimistic when you see these groups of people putting together these plans and taking the bull by the horns and doing things that they feel they can make work. So there's a lot of strength in Minnesota, and we're in it together, and we'll get through it.
So when the people get the opportunity to rebound, looks like they will. Okay, thank you very much. And this segment was partially paid for by the Gary Dames for Senate campaign and the Paul Torkelson for State Representative campaign. Thank you.